I was talking about mitochondria, and I didn't quite finish the slide, because what I wanted to tell you is that, well, I've already told you that it's one of the multiply membrane-bounded organelles, right? It has two membranes. And the reason for that is because of how mitochondria came into existence. This is known as the endosymbiotic theory for mitochondria. Endosymbiotic, I've used that word before, that refers to something living within some other species. Well, when eukaryotes were just beginning as cells, there were already bacteria that were capable of cellular respiration. Bacteria invented cellular respiration. And so they were busy leading their own lives, of course. Early eukaryotic cells were going around eating bacteria. They would engulf them as food. And of course, that usually kills the bacteria when they're eaten. But for whatever reason, an engulfed bacterium survived that process and continued living within the eukaryotic cell. And that became the first mitochondrion. And therefore, that was how eukaryotes became capable of cellular respiration, by housing formerly free-living bacteria as a new organelle. And this is why they're doubly membrane-bounded. The bacterium had one membrane. When a eukaryote engulfs another cell, it wraps its plasma membrane around it, but for endocytosis, and makes it, you know, wraps it in a vesicle, basically, so that outer membrane is what the bacterium was coated with when it got engulfed and survived the process. This also explains why mitochondria have their own DNA, because the bacterium had DNA. Plus, that DNA is not like the eukaryotic DNA in the same cell. It is like bacterial DNA. And not only do eukaryotes have their own DNA, as we've talked about, they also have their own ribosomes. All ribosomes in all cells function the same way to produce polypeptides via translation. But molecularly speaking, the ribosomes in mitochondria are just like bacterial ribosomes, not like eukaryotic ribosomes. So the ribosomes in the same cell but outside of the mitochondria are molecularly different. Plus, if all of that isn't good enough evidence for the endosymbiotic theory, how these came into existence, it's also true that mitochondria replicate themselves. They split into two to create new mitochondria, just like bacteria split into two by binary fission to create new bacteria. Now in 15, we see another organelle that started this same way via endosymbiosis. This is a chloroplast. We've already talked about it a little bit. The job is photosynthesis. Well, just like bacteria invented cellular respiration before there were any eukaryotic cells, bacteria also invented photosynthesis. So photosynthesis was on the scene for a long time before there was such a thing as a eukaryotic cell. And these things are multiply membrane-bounded for the same reason. A eukaryotic cell engulfed a photosynthetic bacterium, and that bacterium survived the process, became the first chloroplast. Now, in cells, imagine the cell I discussed earlier about the mitochondrion. It engulfed an aerobic cellular respiration capable bacterium, and that became the first mitochondria. That is our ancestor, us animals, which is why we have mitochondria, but not chloroplasts. Somewhere along the line, an offshoot of that lineage, which already had mitochondria, engulfed a photosynthetic bacterium to create the first chloroplast, and that is the ancestor to plants, which is why plants have both mitochondria and chloroplasts. But all of those things that I said about mitochondria, all that evidence pointing to endosymbiosis creating them, is also true for chloroplasts. Chloroplasts have their own DNA, which is bacterial-like. They have multiple membranes. They have their own ribosomes. They create new chloroplasts by binary fission. Just to remind you about the... we haven't seen this detail yet. Let's take a look at the inside of a chloroplast. This is one chloroplast. Now, there are three membranes that are named here, even though technically it's really just two membranes. But there are three names. There's an outer membrane. And then there's an inner membrane. And then the green stuff, all of which is made of membrane material, is called the thylakoid membrane. But the thylakoid membrane is really continuous with the inner membrane. It's just here and there it folds inward and becomes elaborately folded into all these coin-looking structures that are each of which is like a little sack. But all the interior is continuous. It's not individual sacks. It's just a very elaborate folding. And so each little sac-like or coin-like structure is a single thylakoid. The membrane is the thylakoid membrane, but one coin in each of these stacks is a thylakoid. Each stack is called a granum. That's the singular of grana. So there are multiple grana within one chloroplast. And just like the inner mitochondrial membrane is highly elaborated or folded to increase surface area, same is true for the thylakoid membrane, so that it can house more and more proteins, which we'll study the functions of when we get to the photosynthesis chapter. The word stroma here is one of the spaces, just like the mitochondrion is compartmentalized, right? We talked about the intermembrane space and the mitochondrial matrix, two different compartments within a mitochondrion. This is a multiple membrane-bounded organelle as well, so it is subcompartmentalized. There's an intermembrane space here between outer and inner membrane. There is the thylakoid space, which is the space inside the coin-like stacks. And then there is the fluid that's inside the inner membrane but outside the thylakoids, and that's what's called the stroma. And they're chemically different from each other. They're not just the same fluid in different places. 16 is just a photomicrograph. So there's no new information here, but it just shows you that these thylakoids are not just cartoon inventions. They really look like that. A lot of surface area. All right, 17 is concentrated on the cytoskeleton, which we've talked a little bit about. It's a highly elaborate network of protein fibers. And how many protein fiber types make up the cytoskeleton?
Three.
Yes. Not all three are shown here, but microtubule is one category. Microfilaments is one category, and the third is intermediate filaments. As far as size is concerned, these are all proteins, but as far as size is concerned, microtubules are the largest diameter. They're the thickest filaments, and as the name implies, they are hollow. They're tubules. Microfilaments are the smallest diameter, and that's why the third category got its name. Intermediate filaments are thicker than microfilaments, but not as thick as microtubules. They also, though, do different jobs. In 18, we see a major job of a microtubule. I mentioned this a little bit before, but you never saw a picture of it. Microtubules form little roadways within the cell. It's part of the cytoskeleton, but a major function of the cytoskeleton using these microtubules is to allow for transport of things from one place in the cell to another place in the same cell. Just like roads allow for transport of things from one place in a city to another place in a city, cargo, like in a truck, can be moved along microtubules. This involves protein in multiple respects. The microtubule itself is protein, but this red thing called a motor protein is also a protein. And it looks like a person, a two-legged person carrying something. This vesicle can be just about anything. That's the cargo. That's what needs to be moved. But the truck is this motor protein that this is not just a cartoon that you see on the photomicrograph, that these are actually two-legged things that walk one step at a time along the microtubule. Each step requires energy. That's what the ATP is for. So it's an expensive process to move things around, but it's important. Well, we finally get a comparative look at these three categories of filaments making up the cytoskeleton. You can see here now the size differences I was talking about. Microtubules are hollow, but they're also widest of the diameter of the three. Microfilaments smaller, intermediate filaments in between. Well, microtubules we just talked about, they're not only involved in moving things from one place to another, they also are going to be really important when we study how cells, eukaryotic cells, divide their nucleus into two as part of cell division. That's mitosis. Microfilaments, the thin ones, are really important in changing the shapes of cells. And that's because they are contractile. Actually, the filaments themselves don't get shorter, which is what contractile means. But cells that have a bunch of these actin microfilaments are able to contract or get shorter because these filaments overlap with each other. And the more they overlap, since they're connected at the other ends to parts of the cell, the more the cell gets shorter. This is how your skeletal muscles work. Increased overlap between myofilaments, which are microfilaments in muscles, myo just means muscle, allows the whole cell to shorten. The intermediate filaments are mostly structural elements. They are just strong rope-like structures that hold things in place, and they withstand tensile forces, forces of being stretched, just like ropes do. Slide 20 is a picture of these centrioles occurring within an animal centrosome. Remember I said that these centrioles, we haven't really figured out what they do. We just know that animals have centrioles in their centrosomes. Other eukaryotes have centrosomes, but their centrosomes don't have centrioles. Well, centrosomes, which is just this kind of yellowish area, are microtubule organizing centers, remember. And so they are not only the places where these microtubules grow from, but they are also two centrosomes are going to form the poles or the opposite ends of a cell that is about to split. And so centrosomes are really important in mitosis. Well, since centrioles are in the centrosomes in animal cells, it would be reasonable to think that they must be involved in mitosis in animal cells. But actually, not only do we not know what they do, but we can actually carefully remove them from animal cells, and the cells can still undergo mitosis. So they're there probably for some reason, but we don't know. And it really shouldn't surprise us that they're able to conduct mitosis without them, because the other groups of eukaryotes do that. Plants have centrosomes that don't have centrioles, and they undergo mitosis just fine as well. So I wish I could tell you more, but that's all we know at the moment. 21 shows you a couple different types of locomotory devices found in some kinds of cells. We talked about a flagella before. A flagellum is the singular. Flagella are whip-like structures, like in a human sperm, for instance, which you're seeing here. Not all cells are flagellated, but some are. And what I mean by a locomotory device is that it is there for the purpose of moving the cell from point A to point B, to propel it through the medium. Flagella can do that, but so can cilia, which are, as far as morphology or shape is concerned, much shorter than flagella. Cilia, the word means hairs. They're not really true hair, but they look like little hairs on cells that have them. Cilia beat back and forth. They move just like flagella do. And so that can cause a cell to tumble kind of through the medium to get from A to B. Cilia, though, are much shorter. And if a cell is ciliated, typically you'll see cilia over most or all of its surface, many, many cilia. If a cell is flagellated, typically you'll see one or just a few number of flagella on one end of the cell, not all over the cell. Now, a cell that is ciliated with many cilia can, as I just said, move from point A to point B. That is if it's a free-living cell, a cell living on its own, not connected to anything. But that's not the case for most of your cells in your body, and you have some ciliated cells, so there's another reason. It's really doing the same thing. The cilia are beating back and forth. But if it's a cell that is connected to something as part of a multicellular animal, for instance, your epithelial cells that line the interior of your trachea or airway are ciliated. There's a lot of cilia on those cells continuously beating back and forth, but they're stuck in place because they're part of a tissue. They're not free living cells. So in that case, the cilia beat not to move the cell through the medium, but to move the medium with respect to the cell. And so they're not only ciliated cells, they are also mucus cells. Mucus, by the way, can be spelled M-U-C-O-U-S or M-U-C-U-S. They don't mean the same thing. They pronounced exactly the same. Mucus, M-U-C-U-S, is the stuff. That is the sticky stuff. Mucus, M-U-C-O-U-S, is an adjective of mucus. So we say that cells are mucus if they produce mucus. It's kind of confusing. But anyway, these cells that are ciliated in your airway also produce mucus. Mucus is sticky stuff. So when you breathe, you're taking in air, of course. That's the intent. You want to get oxygen in there. You want to get CO2 out on the way back. But you don't breathe in just air. Just oxygen. You breathe in everything that's in air, including not only other gases, but also a bunch of debris. Not just non-living debris like dirt and stuff, but also pathogens, potential pathogens. Bacteria live in the air as well. And so anyway, the mucus that's produced by these cells allow that solid stuff that you don't want to get down into your lungs to stick to. That holds them in place so that you don't breathe it in all the way into your alveoli. But the fact that they're ciliated means that that mucus, that layer of mucus, is continuously being whipped upward toward your throat. And then intermittently throughout the day, you swallow naturally. And that puts all that mucus and the stuff that it stuck to it into your stomach, which is a good idea because your stomach, because of its very low pH, is the most inhospitable place in your body for anything that is trying to live in you and maybe potentially harm you. So that's an example of cilia not propelling the cell, but moving the medium itself. In 22, we're looking at the molecular structure within just one cilium and it's a bundle of several different proteins, including in yellow, notice, a bunch of microtubules. So microtubules are used in cilia as well. But it's not just microtubules. Notice these red things. Those are motor proteins, just like I showed you and told you are acting like trucks. Well, if it's a motor protein acting as a roadway a microtubule acting as a roadway and a motor protein walking along it, it's carrying something from one place in the cell to another. But in this arrangement, we have these microtubules that are not really so much roadways. Still, though, the motor proteins will try to walk along them. Notice that they don't have a vesicle carrying a specific cargo. They are connected at their other end to another microtubule. So if you imagine these walking along, that's going to make one microtubule move with respect to the other microtubule. Like, for instance, if I use pieces of paper. If you have this microtubule and this microtubule with motor proteins between them, they'll just do this, right? Well, that wouldn't bend the cilium. So that's why you also have these blue proteins, which are tethering the microtubules in place, which is more like a bent piece of paper, because now the two microtubules are connected, represented by the fold. And therefore, if they try to walk against next to each other, it's going to bend instead. And so that's how the cilia beat back and forth to do the things they do. Actually, you can see that in this picture. I just used paper to do the same thing. But in 23, you can see this. Because of these tethering, when the motor proteins try to walk, it actually just bends the whole complex. That's also a very expensive process. Just one of the thousands and thousands of reasons why you continuously are spending ATP molecules and having to make new ATP molecules from fuel molecules that are in food. Photomicrograph showing you that this cytoskeletal structure I've been talking about can be pretty complex, especially at the edges of cells, because it goes into the interior of microvilli, as you see here. There's microfilaments, intermediate filaments. These actin microfilaments are the ones that I was talking about that can change the shape of things, including how your skeletal muscles work. Well, that's also shown in 25. So this is a muscle cell. And a muscle cell is a long cell. Because however big the whole muscle is, like biceps brachii, for instance, it's a bundle of many cells, but they're all side by side and they're all running the entire length of the muscle. One cell. And in that cell, it's sectioned it's chambered lengthwise, kind of like cars of a freight train, into these subunits called sarcomeres.
Are called Z-lines. You don't really have to know this detail. But anyway, this is one functional unit, and there's many end-to-end within one muscle cell. And these proteins, like I said, don't get shorter. They increase their overlap. But since they're tethered to these Z-discs, that means the whole chamber gets a little bit shorter when they increase their overlap. And the same exact thing is happening in all of these little subunits along the length. So each one doesn't get much shorter, but when you add them all up, the whole train gets much shorter, and that's what pulls on the bone. But the same kinds of contractile proteins can be used in cells that we call amoebas. Amoeba is not a species. You might have looked at amoebas before under a microscope in some class. Amoebas are just free-living cells that have this type of movement, which is to continuously change shape based on these proteins contracting, causing contraction. And that bulges a part of the cell out called a false foot or pseudopodium,
and then it sticks to a surface and then drags the rest of the cell behind it. It's continuously making new pseudopodia to get from A to B. And another use of the same kinds of proteins are found in plant cells. You can actually see this in lab when you're looking at plant cells. The reason that plant cells are nice to look at is that you don't have to stain them in order to see them. Most, like a typical animal cell, is pretty transparent because it doesn't have any pigments. But chloroplasts are easy to see because they have green pigment, which is how they operate for photosynthesis. Anyway, when you put them under a light microscope, you can, after a minute or two, you can see that these chloroplasts begin to move. They're actually trying to reposition themselves to get as much light as possible, the light from the microscope in that case. And that's called cytoplasmic streaming. It's movement of the cytoplasm within the cell because of these contractile proteins that are part of the cytoskeleton. All right, 26. I mentioned plasmodesmata before. We just see them in greater detail here. Plasmodesmata are examples of plant intercellular junctions. An intercellular junction is simply a place where two cells join together. And plasmodesmata, being little tunnels, allow for certain kinds of materials to pass from one cell to the next. So it allows for cell-to-cell communication in plants. We'll look at animal versions of intercellular junctions in a minute. But first, in 27, we see the cytoskeleton being involved here again. Now, this is part of the plasma membrane, as it's labeled, and these integrins, as they're labeled, are proteins of various kinds for various reasons. But a plasma membrane, and we'll look at the structure of a plasma membrane in its own chapter, next chapter. It's a pretty fragile device, though, pretty flimsy, because these phospholipids that make it up are not actually bonded together chemically. They are still their own individual molecules. And so if you pull on this thing, you can easily break it. So what we have here is using proteins for strain relief. The proteins that are part of the membrane are hooked to proteins of the cytoskeleton inside the cell, and they're also hooked to proteins in the extracellular matrix, the stuff outside of the cell. So if something pulls on this stuff outside of the cell, it will pull on a protein in the membrane, but it won't rupture the membrane and pull that protein out, because it in turn is hooked to strong intermediate filaments within the cell. So it's strain relief. Just another photomicrograph to show you that we didn't make up these little tunnel-like structures. They really do exist, plasmodesmata, between cells. And plasmodesmata are tunnels, as I've said, but they tunnel through the cell wall material, which is thick and strong between adjacent plant cells. Now, in 29, we can look at animal versions of intercellular junctions. Now, we animals don't have plasmodesmata, or at least that's not what they're called, I should say, but we have very similar things. Those are called gap junctions. This picture, by the way, is a cutaway view of one cell that we're looking at the interior of, or half of a cell. The front half has been taken away. And then right next to it would be another cell on the other side. So you can see where gap junctions is labeled, that these are little protein complexes that form little tunnels between animal cells. And so gap junctions are the animal version of plasmodesmata. A good example in your body occurs in your cardiac myocytes, in other words, your heart cells. Your heart, in order to function properly, has to function as an efficient pump. And it functions as a pump because it's muscle. And when it contracts, that squeezes the blood that's in that chamber at the moment into another chamber. But to do that efficiently, all of the cells that make up the wall of the chamber, whether it's an atrium or a ventricle, need to almost simultaneously contract. They can't just contract any old time. They need to contract pretty much in synchrony so that it forces the blood to the next place, either to the ventricle or out through a major artery. Well, this is done because when a cell, when a single muscle cell in the heart wall contracts, that's because of ions being pumped around, or ions flowing, I should say. So it's a flow of electrical charge that causes this. Gap junctions allow for that flow of ions, which is, starts out in one cell, to continue on to the next cell. And therefore, all you have to do is stimulate that first cell, and all of the cells get stimulated in that entire chamber. So gap junctions are useful for that reason and others. But they're little tunnels. Gap junctions are not really about holding cells together. They're about intercellular communication. But there are animal intercellular junctions whose job it is to hold cells together in a tissue. And those are called desmosomes. Now, desmo means tree, because it kind of looks like a bush or a tree, but it's a complex of proteins, and notice that it extends from one cell into another cell. A desmosome is, functionally speaking, more or less a spot weld. When you have two pieces of sheet metal and you don't weld them continuously everywhere, you just weld them in one spot, that holds the two together. Spot welding is used in car manufacturing, for instance, and it holds them together pretty well. And that's why you see them here and there. Desmosomes hold those cells to the adjacent or next door cells so that the whole tissue, which is millions of cells, is held in place. And then the one above it, the one shown in the picture above the desmosomes, is a tight junction, which is a pretty big complex of proteins, and you see that it has a kind of a width to it. It's kind of like a piece of double-sided tape that goes all the way around this cell. The front's been removed, but it would be a loop all the way around. And I say double-sided because it will adhere all of those cells all the way around that first cell to that first cell. Well, it kind of seems like they're doing the same job as desmosomes, but tight junctions, even though they do hold cells together, are not really about structural integrity like desmosomes are. Tight junctions are there to allow for a seal. Up to this point in the course, whenever I've used the word membrane, I've been talking about a subcellular structure, like the plasma membrane or the membrane of a membrane-bounded organelle, smaller than a cell, right? A phospholipid bilayer and other stuff thrown in there is what I've meant every time I've said membrane so far. But there's also a macroscopic use of the word membrane, like the epidermis of your skin, which is the part of the skin you can touch directly. That is an example of a multicellular membrane. It's not a subcellular structure. It's made of many cells, right? So you get a bunch of cells together, however many layers. That's a multicellular membrane. Totally different use of the word. But if you are a particle trying to get through this multicellular membrane, then there are two ways, really, fundamentally speaking, that you could do this if you're successful. One way would be to enter the first cell you encounter in that outer layer, go through that cell, then go out the other side of the cell and into the next cell and the next layer and so on for however many layers. That would be called the cellular route because you are entering cells to do that. The only other possibility would be to take what's called the paracellular route. Para means
next to.
And the paracellular route means that that particle, whatever it is, doesn't enter any cells in the membrane.
Instead, it would have to go in the spaces between cells all the way through the whole macroscopic membrane.
Well, tight junctions evolved as a way to block that paracellular route. So here we can see this in the red arrow. This tight junction blocks whatever this thing following the red arrows is from getting farther than this point. It can squeeze in the space between these two cells only up to this point, and then the tight junction stops it. Oh, 30 is we're done with this chapter, because this is another one of these summary slides that I've kept here just in case you want to use it to study, but I've covered all of that stuff.